Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, best-selling mystery novelist Sarah Paretsky chats with Booklist editor Donna Seaman about Overboard, the latest book in Paretsky's V.I. Warshawski detective series. This conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022 at the American Writers Museum and was recorded live as part of the museum's inaugural American Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Well, welcome to our final program here of the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I'm a program coordinator here at the American Writers Museum. And so our final American Writers Festival program this evening is a very special one, the launch of a legend's newest book. Sarah Paretsky revolutionized the mystery world in 1982 when she introduced V.I. Warshawski in Indemnity Only. Paretsky challenged a genre where women typically were vamps or victims. Hailed by critics and readers, Indemnity Only was followed by 20 more best-selling Warshawski novels published in 30 countries. V.I. reflects Paretsky's passion for social justice with strong advocacy for literacy and reproductive rights. In 1986, she created Sisters in Crime, earning her Miss Magazine's Woman of the Year award. Other awards include the British Crime Writers Cartier Diamond Dagger for Lifetime Achievement, the Mystery Writers of America Grandmaster, and several honorary doctorates. She's here to talk about her new book, Overboard, with Booklist adult books editor and American Writers Festival advisor, Donna Seaman. Please join me in welcoming Sarah and Donna.
Yay. Thank you so much, Courtney. Welcome, Sarah. Congratulations on your 22nd V.I. Warshawski novel.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here with me, even in cyberspace. And as I said before we got started, I really apologize not to be there in person, but I've been sitting out a COVID exposure that I didn't want to share with the world. And it's also a chance for everyone to see my office.
Yes, I love that.
And a piece of my dog.
And who is the dog I saw there?
That's Kiara.
So, you know, dogs play a really important part in Overboard. In fact, a dog starts out the opening scene. Why are dogs important to you, Sarah?
You know, I grew up not liking dogs. And then I married someone with three sons, and the four of them had never been without a dog. And I fought and screamed and kicked. And then we took care of a golden retriever for a family that went to England for a year. And I think you'd have to be Joseph Mengele if your heart was not melted by a golden retriever. That dog kind of brought us together as a family. My stepsons were not in a happy place, and they were teenagers. And that first golden retriever kind of knitted us together. And so they've remained important to me. I will say V.I.'s dogs are mostly better behaved than mine ever have been. I think she trains them meticulously, except in the opening to Overboard, where they do not come when they are called.
Yeah, they seem pretty rowdy throughout this book. So let's talk about V.I. You and she have been a pair for 40 years now. And I say, in this book, she is as intense, ornery, smart, tough as ever. Do you find her to be the same good companion she's been all along?
You know, I'm so glad she seems that way to you, Donna. I think that she is a little more melancholy maybe than she was in the beginning. The first book came out in 1982, 40 years ago, and we were feeling our oats, I guess. We were cresting a wave of possibility for women. V.I. came out the same year that Chicago first let women be part of the regular police force. And we were soon having Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court, and everything just seemed possible. Recent political events seem to have closed that window for us in worrying ways. And V.I. is not going to stop fighting, but the odds look higher to her than they did at the beginning.
Yeah, so true. And of course, you wrote this book during COVID, and COVID is part of the seeing. I mean, everyone's having to deal with it. And I was very intrigued in how you worked that in, including times when masks were useful in other ways than just keeping us healthy.
No, it was a... It's a real challenge when you're writing books that are set in the present and they're dealing with contemporary issues. You don't want to take on something that's going to be obsolete by the time the book is finished. And I kept, because I don't like to say I'm a slow writer. I'm a very fast writer, but I'm a very slow thinker. And it takes me a long time to think through scenes, see if they're working or not. So it's a two-year journey for me, and something that is important on day one isn't going to be important on day 730 or whatever the end of 2 years is. With COVID, I kept going back and forth. I thought, okay, it's important. Then we had the vaccine. It's not going to be part of the landscape. Then it was clear that it was going to be with us for a long time. And so it seemed to me the book is not about COVID, but it's about people navigating COVID, as we all have to do, including me.
Yeah, case in point tonight. Well, it adds a rich dimension and another layer, and it brings us into a lot of issues you've addressed before. You know, I love your books because they're so intricately plotted. This one in particular is exciting every paragraph. And also you address such urgent, important issues. And one of them in this case is the whole for-profit healthcare system, which is a nightmare. And you work that in as part of the story, not to do with COVID, but you can't help but think about what we saw that first year.
Thank you. Yes, that was where I started thinking about this book. It started actually, I was visiting a brother who lives in Columbia, Missouri. And I was shocked by the number of homeless people I encountered. I mean, homeless people are with us in every city, but in Chicago, you don't see them in every doorway the way you do in Columbia. So I started talking to some of the people that I met on the streets, and a number of them had been made homeless by their medical bills. And they came into Columbia hoping to find work or hoping to get health care. One guy in particular with a family living on the street had broken his shoulder falling from a roof, working for a roofer who didn't have workers' comp. And so I started really thinking about the way that the healthcare, I hate to call it a system when it's, well, it's systematically sucking people's life savings away from them. But that was where I started thinking about the book. And then it became a challenge to come up with a story that wasn't like just a rant, and furthermore, and notwithstanding, you know. So.
Right. Yes, no rants here. It's completely woven together. And another thing I really notice in this book, as I always enjoy in your books, is so VI remains vital and inspiring, and so does Chicago. And you bring us to some very new aspects of Chicago history, the Chicago River. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the city is always new to you.
Yes, in particular, the Chicago River, which I had never really paid much attention to as a Chicagoan or as a writer. And then my dog, fortunately, Kiara, broke her foot. That was not good. But her vet is near the Chicago River, and because of COVID, every time I went in for changing the cast or any of those things, I had to stay outside. So I'm walking the streets along near the Chicago River. And it's such an interesting landscape. Like close up, there are rushes and there are geese nesting in the rushes. And then I was standing at the Chicago Avenue Bridge looking down, and there's that thumb. Goose Island is kind of diagonally in front of you. And then there's that thumb that you drive over on the Kennedy on your way to O'Hare. And I don't know what used to be there, some kind of plant, of factory, something, printing press. But it's empty and it's huge. And so I just started imagining that as a place where a mansion stood, something that had belonged to one of the robber barons 160 years ago. And now is kind of decrepit. And I just fell in love with my imaginary mansion and that setting. And then I started reading up on that land thumb, and it turns out that it's ripe for development. There's a Canadian company that's put in a $200 million bid for building some luxury condos there. So that became part of the story too, is people trying to drive my old lady out of her home so that they can tear that beautiful mansion down and turn it into condos.
That house is a great setting, really wonderful. And I guess we can back up a little bit and say that the novel, the opening scene is on the lakefront, actually, and VI's dogs discover a teenage girl that's kind of hiding in the rocks down there, and she is connected to this mansion in some way. She's a great character, and another aspect of this novel I was really struck by was your use of digital technology in terms of detection, but also like surveillance and how dependent young people are on their devices. I want to ask you, like, how deliberate that inclusion is, and did you do any sort of research for your, there's drones, there's phones, there's burner phones, there's everything.
You know, all of my research, fittingly enough, all my research was online, for at least for that, but they're definitely, There is a drone surveillance system called Stingrays and Dirt something. I can't think of Dirt what. Dirt Boxes, I think, which law enforcement uses all over this country for surveilling. Anytime you're on the street, there's a drone overhead watching you. And especially if you're taking part in any kind of march, protest, demonstration, you are on candid camera with these law enforcement surveillance drones. And then I started, drones are a total mystery to me, but some of them are quite small that you can't really see them overhead. And so then I started, as I started reading about them, I saw that one of the problems with them is that they're not like interactive computers. They're a CPU, a central processing unit, is too heavy, even in the minute size of a cell phone, for a drone to carry around and be an independent computer. But people are working on that technology. And so I have a character who's really mastering ways to make drones independent computers. So I don't know. I'm doing a program tomorrow night with three other writers, all of whom write sort of fantasy sci-fi. And I thought, well, there's a way in which Overboard fits into that. My agent, although he liked the book, said he thought the ending smacked a little bit too much of Star Wars. And I thought, you know, what can I say? That is just life these days. It's all like Star Wars in a way.
I love the ending, which we're not going to talk about because you have to read the book. So, yes, so the drone fits into this family drama. And this is a family, the Litvox, is that how you say that? Yes, that has appeared in your novels. I mean, the great thing about this series is that it's a great web of relationships tied to a Southside neighborhood and to VI's father, who was a policeman, and her cousin, Boom Boom, who was in the Blackhawks. And so this family, we've heard of them before, and now we see them in all their incredible, dysfunctional, sort of non-glory. I mean, you talk about those characters a little bit.
You know, every time I have VI go back to South Chicago, which is where she grew up, I feel that the book is richer for me. I'm not a native Chicago, and I've lived here now since a long time, 55 years, is that possible? I grew up in rural Kansas, so I can't explain why South Chicago feels like home to me, but every time I send VI back there and the people that she grew up with, the novels come to life for me in ways that they sometimes don't. And the Litvak family in particular, you know, they're kind of like a fish out of water family. They're Jewish in a mostly Catholic part of Chicago, and the father is really not an attractive character, angry all the time, but he runs a women's clothing store, more or less. It's a general store, but mostly specializes in women's clothing. So it's kind of like some of the little shops in my hometown. And Maybe that's why I like South Chicago so much, because it really is like its own small town, just like where I grew up. And so the Litvox, I think we're just going to keep seeing more of them. Sonia is the one girl in a family of boys, and she's the one who kind of keeps them all, insofar as they're at all coherent, she's the one who kind of keeps them together. I should have marked the part of the chapter where there's one night Boom Boom is hanging out with one of the Litvak boys when they're teenagers, and the Litvak boys are stealing liquor off the back of trucks. They're working for a local mob figure, stealing liquor off the backs of trucks and reselling it to mob favored liquor stores on the south side. And when VI's father finds out that Boom Boom is running on the sort of outskirts of the mob, he brings VI into the police station late at night with Boom Boom, and he does something rather shocking for Tony Warshawski, but he makes it clear to VI and to her cousin that if Boom Boom continues to hang out with the Litvak boys, VI is going to be sent to Warsaw to live with her great aunt Veronica.
Right, exiled. But yes, and so there's a new generation, Donnie's son and other cousins, and they're really great characters. And I think you're right that levels of connection to those Chicago neighborhoods are really powerful and strong and play in good counterpoint to the other storylines you have going on. Another timely subject here, sadly, hate crimes. And so part of the story is set in a very humble synagogue that kind of comes under assault. I wonder if you could talk about that situation, those characters a little bit.
Yes, I really struggled writing Overboard in a way that I haven't for a long time with any book. I kept reimagining characters and reimagining scenes, and they would take me way too far away from my central storyline. And then as I was driving through Rogers Park and along Devon and looking at all of the old small synagogues there, it seemed to me that another piece of the story would be VI's connection to the Jewish world of Chicago and the Italian Jews in Chicago through her dead mother, who was in fact an Italian Jew and a refugee from Mussolini's race laws. Which brings us to a sensitive point of how old is VI? How old is her mother? And how can this be contemporary when none of them has aged more than 20 years in 40 years? And that is just a fact that some readers are happy with, and some feel that I should get over it and let VI become old and more like Sherlock Holmes' brother, Mycroft, and solve crimes from her armchair overlooking the streets. But
not yet.
I want her to stay around 50 years old and be active and vigorous and maybe continue to do the things that I can't do.
I love that she stays vital and on the scene and in the field. It's very exciting and totally convincing.
So the synagogue, I do not know Hebrew, and I decided I would name the synagogue for Leonard Cohen's childhood synagogue in Montreal. And I did, except that I inadvertently left out a letter in the name, and the woman who was doing the audio recording, she reached out and she said she went to her local rabbi and said, "I don't recognize this word." And he said, "That's because it isn't a word in Hebrew, transliterated into English." And so I looked it up and I thought, oh my God, this went through so many layers of editing. Me, my personal copy reader here in Chicago, a friend who read it, 10 readers in New York, my agent. And it's like, nobody caught that. And so I frantically called New York, called my editor, and it was the last day that you could make changes in the type. So the audio reader, I should dedicate an entire series to her for sparing me months of letters from, "Dear Ms. Peretsky, I am so disappointed that you and your editor and..."
Oh, gosh. Yes, that was very fortunate. It never fails to astonish me how things like that happen in publishing. I mean, we go through this all the time at the magazine. It's very tough. Yeah, it's very tough. But that storyline was, I found very moving, of course.
Thank you. As it developed, it became more and more important to me too. My husband was a member of the University of Chicago physics faculty, and one of his colleagues was, in fact, an Italian Jew who was rescued by a Gentile family and spent the war years in hiding with them. And then after the war, when he was able to reclaim his identity, he changed his surname to this family's name in honor of them for their role in saving his life. So that story also just felt really, I mean, it doesn't really come into the book, but at the same time, it's kind of the context that drives the story forward.
You know, your story about getting the temple name having to be corrected reminds me that I wanted to ask you about the title of this book, which I think also had to be changed for a very different reason. Is that right?
Correct, yes. So Overboard was originally called Double Dirty. And there was a journalist, Peter Finlay Dunne, who wrote a column in a very Irish brogue. I find them really hard to read because why couldn't he have just written in standard English? But he's doing dialect through all of his columns. They were written right around 1900. And he had a character, Mr. Dooley, who reflected on Chicago politics. And I will say Mr. Dooley's reflections continue to ring true today. Mm. So one of his columns talks about a roving crap game that was played under the viaducts in Chicago. And when they were fleecing newcomers to the city, greenhorns, they would call it doing the double dirty, namely taking a dirty pair of dice and throwing a double dirty pair. So I thought that was perfect for this book because there were so many dirty deeds. And in fact, there continues to be a rolling crap game under the Chicago Viaduct. They have a friend who used to drive trucks for the mob when he was in high school. And he said that was one of the things when he was a teenager and wanted to be one of the big guys, you know, that was one of the things they would do on Saturday nights. They would just park their trucks and go under the bridges and play this crap game. And so that plays a role in the book. So there we are calling it Double Dirty, and the page proofs or the cover jacket proofs are going out to different sites like Amazon and so on. And then someone did a title check, and there were 10 other books called Double Dirty that were published in the last year. And all of them were extremely raunchy porn that, and you could tell from the jacket covers exactly what was going on in the books. And in fact, one of them seemed to involve a horse. So we quickly scrambled, because then again, I could imagine the letters from readers. I bought this book and there was no, you know, sexual perversions of any kind. And so my money was taken from me under false pretenses. So my agent actually suggested Overboard, which I thought was a great second choice as a title, because in fact, people are going overboard all the time, falling in the Chicago River and going overboard with their emotional and financial frenzies. So it worked as a second choice title, but I do kind of miss Double Dirty.
That's a great story. But yes, Overboard is excellent. It's excellent. You know, when you were talking about that journalist, it reminded me of two of my favorite characters in here who are really important allies to BI, and they're both journalists. There's Marie and what's her name? Kate Blackson.
Beth.
So can you, and Marie Ryerson, so can you talk a little bit about your feelings about journalism and its importance? And I mean, it's interesting the way VI works with them to kind of help with her case, but also in general, the importance of journalists, which I think gets overlooked too much.
Yes, this is another thing that I feel really passionately about, that investigative reporting has historically been the the way that we've preserved democracy in this country, and that with the conglomeratization, with the merging together of big media companies, every time a paper was bought by a big media company, they would cut the investigative journalist staff in half, and every time they did that, their stock price would double. So we have really lost a key element in protecting us, I think, in losing journalists. And Murray Ryerson, he's been with VI from the beginning, and his career and the way that journalism has changed over the four decades of this series is kind of, I think, a reflection of what's happened in the bigger world. So VI can't get a prosecutor to bring charges against someone either because the evidence is not cast iron or because that person has too much power. But Murray could write them up in the pages of the Herald Star, the fictional paper that I created for the series. But then the Herald Star was bought by Global Entertainment, and they got rid of Murray's job, and they kind of sidelined him to a cable, weekly cable series on Chicago, things happening in Chicago. And for a while, he and VI were kind of at odds because she felt he'd sold out and he felt he had a right to pay his bills. And she would point to his baby blue Mercedes convertible and say, "You didn't need to pay that bill money." But with the previous book, with Deadland, he finally cut the cord between himself and Global Entertainment. They'd pushed something too far for him in Deadland. And so now he's doing freelance work, and that gives him more scope, really, for doing investigative journalism, but it doesn't give him more scope for earning a living, since a lot of those outlets pay nothing or very little. The other person who gets involved in this is Beth Blackson, who is the investigative, well, she works for Global Entertainment, but she also works with VI, and she doesn't have the luxury of doing the kind of in-depth stories that Murray used to do, but she still is more or less on the side of the angels, and so she will help out in a pinch. I had kind of fun with, like, Global is like all of these big conglomerates, you know, they're it's all about them and their culture and so on. And so they have a van, which all the TV stations do, of course, which trundles around the city to cover events, but it's called Global Mobile, and they spell it MOBAL because, you know, they're just so cute. They love their mobile van. And even Beth has a drone that she steals from the company to try to cover the opening scene on the lakefront.
Yeah, she's a great character. I like their exchanges. I was really struck by a line in thinking about what journalists do. You wrote, "Way too many people are living in a world of lies, secrets, and delusions." For sure. Yes.
Yes. And, you know, there was a time when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted person in America, and we knew that insofar as it was possible to get real news, true news, that he was delivering it to us, or Edward R. Murrow beforehand. Now, anyone can say anything, and they don't have to back it up with data, and the more outrageous it is, the more outrageous the lie, the bigger the following seems to become, so that you have people who believe that there was a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., the center of a pedophilia ring, and they believe it so much that somebody came with a rifle and shot at people in the pizza parlor. So there are no checks on what anyone says in any forum.
It's such a paradox, too, because there's that, you know, rampaging lies, the big lie, small lies, bizarre conspiracy theories. But then we have people banning books and trying to censor what young people read. And so, I mean, either extreme is so difficult to navigate.
Yes, and it's so hard to know how you hold both those ideas in your head at the same time. But but it does seem possible, apparently.
I was also struck in thinking about this novel about how many times you have written about police brutality in Chicago, and you bring us to a very terrifying place, the Holman Square Station in Overboard, where VI is actually subjected to some, I mean, she gets beat up in this book. She really suffers. And I wonder.
I'm bad about that, but in Deadland, the previous book, she came away pretty unscathed, so.
So it's time again.
No, I don't know. Poor VI. Oh, God, what do I do to her? I wouldn't survive what she goes through, that's for sure.
No. But was that place based on something real, that Holman Square?
It's real. It's been covered by the Guardian newspaper, and that's how I found out.
The Guardian overseas covers a Chicago reality.
And the Guardian does a good job on U.S. news, actually. But if you start looking it up, if you start searching through archives on it, you'll find that, now I've made up what the interior looks like, and I've made up a lot of the activity that goes on there. But in fact, people are, mostly people of color, are taken there and held without warrants and without any information about their whereabouts being released to the public. So it's a frightening thing that's happening in our city, replacing the Burge
ring
from the South Side.
Yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, it's, and
there are also good cops in the city, and I have good cops in the book too. So, and I have friends who are part of the police force, and I'm grateful to them for the support they give me and the information they give me. And I try not to paint it as just a one-size-fits-all kind of picture of the Chicago police.
That's right. I really like that part of the story where there's good cops and bad cops, and people giving VI a break, and then people who would like just assume kill her. So it's, you do show us a wide spectrum of people involved.
So there's one scene where Detective Finchley, who's one of the, Lieutenant Finchley, who's one of the good cops, he happens along as one of the bad cops, is in the one who takes VI ultimately to Holman Square. But the VI's first encounter with this detective, Coney, his name is, and Mr. Contreras is out there in his maroon dressing gown in the middle of the night, and it's 3 a.m, and this guy's about to beat VI up, and then Finchley comes along and points out that people on the street are videoing what's going on, and so Coney leaves for the time being. And Mr. Contreras says to him that he wanted to muzzle me. That means I was getting under his skin. Mr. Contreras was complacent. Finchley rolled his eyes. Getting under his skin is easy. Getting out from under it, not so much. You're a pit dog, Warshawski. You'll go into the ring with anyone as long as they're at least 3 times your size. You and Contreras don't know how to draw a line. And then as he's leaving, Mr. Contreras has said to Coney, you know, if you saw Joe Louis, he'd smash you like a cockroach. And Finchley comes back and says, Joe Louis, what century are you living in? I seen him fight, my neighbor said. He was entertaining the troops and did exhibitions. He'd have taken that Coney fella apart like a cheap watch. And who takes watches apart these days, Finchley said, but he was whistling as he walked to his car. So it was kind of fun writing that juxtaposition. And then I always like Mr. Contreras coming out in his maroon.
I love Mr. Contreras. So remind people who that is and why he can remember Joe Louis.
His neighbor, and he's in his 90s. He fought at Anzio. And so he saw Joe Louis do exhibition round matches for the troops as part of the, what do they call it, USO? And the people who go around and entertain the troops.
Yeah, the USO, yeah. He's a great character. He always wants to do more. He wants to get in there. And of course, he's always helping out.
Yes, and he has a pipe wrench that is his favorite.
He has a pipe wrench and the bathroom. Yeah. And Lottie's in this novel too. People are fans of the series. They know about Lottie.
Yes, she's a doctor who, when I wrote the first book and knew that VI needed to be patched up, but didn't need to go to the hospital or couldn't afford to take the time to go to the hospital. I relied on Rex Stout and his Nero Wolfe books because he had a doctor up the street, Doc Vollmer, who would patch up Nero Wolfe's clients for him. And I thought, well, VI needs a Doc Vollmer. But in fact, it's a feminist doctor, also another refugee, former refugee now.
Right.
Important U.S. doctor. So the recurring characters like Sal, the bartender who owns the Golden Glow, Lottie, the doctor, Mr. Contreras, I try to rotate them so that in some books one has a bigger role. Also the same with Murray and with Beth Blackson, so that they each have a chance to be more of a star in the cast of characters.
Right. It works really well. So are you thinking of the 23rd VI book?
I am. I'm on page 25.
And
I actually have a title for it, which lately I haven't had titles until long after the draft was done, but I'm calling it Land's End, L-A-N-D apostrophe S, Land's End. It's kind of hard to say what it's about, except it's about land and possibly about cryptocurrencies and the way that they suck up. I'm not going to try to write about cryptocurrencies. I can't make head or tail of them, but all I can say is they are environmentally hazardous.
Right.
There's a teacher who just got fired for being too woke for her school board, and just a whole bunch of other stuff happening. And the Northwestern women's basketball team, one of the recurring characters in the series is a girl, Bernardine, who was VI's cousin, Boom Boom's goddaughter. And then when he died, he kind of bequeathed her to VI. And she plays hockey for Northwestern. And her roommate, Angela, is a basketball star. So they all go down to Kansas to watch Angela score her 3,000th point, which is a big milestone for any player, especially. There have only been about 10 women who've scored 3,000 points as college students. So, and that's where the story begins.
That sounds great. I'm so happy to hear that. I love that you are just reach into so many different realms. It's just fascinating, Sarah.
I live alone, so everything that I do is inside my head. I don't know what that says.
That's a writer's life. Thank you. Courtney's here to help.
Thank you to our program participants for being here today and for all of you for allowing us to celebrate American writing safely. And again, please join me in thanking Sarah and Donna for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah. Wonderful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and Washington Post associate editor David Marinus discusses his new biography, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.